This week could prove a dangerous turning point for the global economy. We've seen major upheavals within European governments, and France and Germany are finally taking the lead in confronting Iran. We're going to look at this and more on today's Trumpet World. Our main story this week could be seen as a relatively small one, but one that has major ramifications. It revolves around President Trump firing just one bureaucrat, and you know, he's fired quite a lot of bureaucrats. But this one could have some world-changing ramifications. To hear more about this, we'll go to our U.S. correspondent, Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this is definitely an interesting story with some fascinating constitutional ramifications. Now, we've known for a while that President Trump, obviously, he favors low interest rates. A lot of Americans would like lower interest rates. It would make it easier for Americans to borrow money. It would stimulate the economy. It'd make it more affordable to buy cars, to get credit cards, to buy houses. But the downside of all that is that inflation's created when you expand the money supply. The government's running a $2 trillion deficit. The current head of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, is trying to keep interest rates high. So some of that government spending gets pulled out of circulation, puts into CDs, puts into high interest savings accounts, puts into other things. And if those rates go lower and that money comes out of the CDs and out of the savings accounts, and then more money is created by borrowing, you're going to get more inflation. President Trump, I think he's said a few times he'd like to fire Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell and get someone who will do lower rates. Now, America has kind of an interesting system where the Federal Reserve is technically a private bank that has a monopoly on control over the U.S. money supply. So even though the president's able to appoint Federal Reserve governors, Federal Reserve chairs, they're not allowed to fire them, except in very limited circumstances. The Federal Reserve Act specifies that they can be fired for cause. And by cause, it basically means like if they've committed some crime. You can't just fire them because you disagree with what their interest rates are going to be, which is why Jerome Powell's job's safe for now. But this one Federal Reserve governor, and I believe there's 12 of them on the Federal Reserve Board, Lisa Cook, has not been convicted, but has at least been accused of mortgage fraud. And so President Trump is using this mortgage fraud allegation as the pretext he needs to get her off the board. I think a lot of people, including myself, believe that he's probably less concerned about whether she committed mortgage fraud and more concerned about getting people who want lower interest rates on the board. And this is just kind of the pretext he needs to make this legal. So he issued an official statement citing the Federal Reserve Act and Article 2 of the Constitution, saying that he wants her out of office. She has sued back, saying that that removal was illegal. And I'll be very interested to see what the courts rule on this. She may have a point. They may end up siding with her that he can't actually get her off the board. But regardless, over whether this kind of interesting constitutional question plays out, Jerome Powell's term ends in April. And so in less than a year, President Trump will be nominating his replacement. And if he does get Lisa Cook off the board, like he's able to nominate her replacement. And he's definitely pushing for an environment where the big, beautiful bill, we're going to be running $2 trillion deficits and have an interest rate of under 3%. My prediction is that is going to create quite a bit of inflation. And then you even had in one of your morning briefs this week, just kind of the prediction too, that in the competition between nations, in order to create jobs and fight trade wars and deal with tariffs, if the U.S. lowers interest rates, a lot of other countries who want their economies to remain competitive will probably have to lower interest rates as well. Which, If it's cheaper to borrow money, more people will do it. And so you're pushing us further, not just the United States, but the globe, further and further into debt and creating more and more inflation that could really have some far-reaching effects, just like upending the world scene.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, the Federal Reserve Central Bank is the global central bank. And what I think has spooked a lot of investors is this idea that now Donald Trump is exerting political control over the central bank to get what he wants, which, you know, I have some sympathy with. This idea, like, I understand why most central banks around the world are independent from the government. And this, especially after COVID, more and more, I just have a problem with this idea of let's delegate big parts of our lives to unelected bureaucrats, unelected experts. Like, I think Britain kind of exposed the lie or even the joke of this, where we had non-partisan, non-political, unelected expert Mark Carney running the Bank of England, who then finishes up running the Bank of England and immediately starts leading a political party and is now Canada's prime minister. Like, he is quite clearly not a neutral, non-partisan expert. He is the opposite of that. Yet he's in the position making all kinds of decisions about people's lives, and there's no democratic oversight because the Bank of England is, you know, independent of the government. So, you know, I don't know about the constitutionalities. I do think it's an interesting question. I understand the idea, though, that, yeah, surely there should be some democratic accountability for these major decisions. I mean, what the interest rate is probably going to have more influence on your life than whatever it is Congress is debating right now. But having said that, you know, what Donald Trump is doing with this, it all looks very pro-inflationary. And you combine that with everything else. You're right. I wrote on this this week. Joshua Michels had an article this week. Well, quite a lot of people really all around the world were writing on this. You kind of combine this with what Donald Trump is doing with stablecoins, and it gets kind of technical, but this could be stablecoins can work as a hidden debt instrument, as yet another way of the US government borrowing money and kind of shading how much or where they borrow that from. A stablecoin would be a cryptocurrency, but instead of going up and down, kind of like Bitcoin and all these other ones do, it stays at the same price as the dollar, but it maintains that price by buying US Treasury bonds. And so you're creating more demand for American debt. And so, you know, all of this is a massive expansion of the dollar, weakening the dollar, leading to high inflation. And this does have global consequences. The Euro Intelligence pointed out that the combination of all of this might pose existential threats to other fiat currencies around the rest of the world. So, you know, it has big issues for everybody that has a non-gold backed currency, which is pretty much everyone. Ambrose Evans Pritchard at The Telegraph, he wrote, the dollar was already on borrowed time as the world's hegemonic reserve currency before the death of the Fed. The process will now accelerate with potent implications for the de-dollarized system of global finance. But the other point that he makes, which I think is a good one, is, you know, Donald Trump is kind of leading America, it seems, to a debt-fueled boom. You know, everything is great for a little bit because America's borrowing a bunch of money. You can buy a bigger house because interest rates are lower. You can borrow, you can for more car payments. You know, you can get a bigger car for the same money. The US government can continue to fund itself by borrowing money at a cheaper rate, and you get all of these big splashy government programs. But it can't last. It's not real growth. It's fake growth. It's growth that's going. You're going to have a massive bust at some point. And also, America's only going to last as long as other countries and other people in other countries are willing to borrow, to lend America money. France, I want to talk about later. They have big debt problems. But one of the things for France is that most of the French government debt is to French people. America's debt, they've got a negative international investment position of about $25 trillion. Its savings rate is incredibly low. So you're not getting people loaning American government out of its savings. It's living off foreign credit. And if foreign creditors decide we're not willing to loan American money anymore, the party stops. And by making these kind of decisions, you're making it less likely that people are going to want to keep loaning America money.
Yeah, all interesting points. Like I said, and this is kind of a controversial issue in the United States because, like I said before, I do feel like the Federal Reserve Governor, Lisa Cook, may have a point about she hasn't officially been charged with mortgage fraud. Therefore, the Federal Reserve Act does not give Donald Trump power to remove her. Like I said, the existence of the Federal Reserve as like this private banking cartel is not part of America's original constitution. It's based on an amendment done in 1913. So something only had for 100 years, and especially amongst libertarians and a lot of the more right wing of the MAGA movement, there's definitely a strong feeling that like the Federal Reserve just needs to be abolished, like the 13th Amendment needs to be undone so that the people do have more control over what the interest rate is. Because like I said, the interest rate is affecting more people than, like I said, yeah, whatever Congress is debating right now. That is an absolutely true statement. Now, with that, like I said, I think Donald Trump, in his efforts to just make people's lives easier, is looking in some short-term thinking, like in terms of personal family finance. A advisor I quote often, Dave Ramsey, always says that like basically that like short-term pain usually causes long-term joy, and short-term joy often causes long-term pain, and so that's basically the Musk-Trump debate over the Big Beautiful Bill in a nutshell. It's like, if you could make some painful budget cuts now, America will continue to be a superpower throughout the century. Where if you don't, like I said, yeah, spending $2 trillion on a Big Beautiful Bill and lowering interest rates to 3% so you can go out and buy a new car and a new house and other things, it's going to make your life easier, and it's going to make the Trump administration go down in the history books as a time of great prosperity in the United States. But like I said, that debt-fueled boom that comes due at some point. And a prophecy we highlight a lot on this show. We've called our editor-in-chief, Mr. Judd Forrest, I called it the late Herbert W. Armstrong's greatest personal prophecy, is that a banking or financial crisis in the United States will be the catalyst that prompts Europe to revive into a united Holy Roman Empire.
Sorry, I've just got a clip we can play from Mr. Armstrong of him saying that, and can hear about it directly from him.
The present economic crisis threatens the very existence of the United States of America. Now, that statement ought to be thundered in banner headlines filling the whole upper half of the front pages of newspapers, and also thundered out in newscasts. But this crisis, the financial crisis, is more serious than the world understands. It not only concerns the United States and Latin America, it is a world economic crisis. I was in London recently at the time of the economic summit of the most powerful nations. And I had meetings there with some of the heads of government. And I can tell you that they were even holding back a lot of the seriousness of the economic situation at this present time. What is happening can suddenly force a unification in Europe, a United States of Europe, that will produce a new world power, a world power colossus, perhaps larger than either the Soviet Union or the United States, and formed for the very purpose of destroying the United States of America. And that very fact is foretold in your Bible in the prophecies of the Bible, believe it or not.
Yeah, so that's a powerful prediction we just heard right there. And we've called it his greatest personal prophecy because there's not a chapter and verse in the Bible I can quote about a financial crisis causing Europe to unite. There's many verses, over 100, that you could quote about a revived Holy Roman Empire conquering end time Israel or the United States. You've got Revelation 17 that talks about 10 kings and verses in Habakkuk that talks about like the evening wolves coming for Israel. So many, many verses that talk about Europe being militarily superior to the United States. That's not the case right now. And for that to be the case, something major has to change. And so if you're just looking at like, well, how could you get a geopolitical alignment that far-reaching happening so fast? And it is like just because of the sheer size of America's debt, it is like its national hill, Achilles heel, its greatest national security threat. And so a debt crisis is something that could really cripple America's ability to defend itself overnight and create a geopolitical crisis so far-reaching that nations as divergent as France and Germany and Italy and Poland, who have just language barriers, cultural barriers, centuries of animosity towards each other, actually unite as one common block to deal with the crisis that was created by the fact that you've got an enormous debt crisis that's just basically overturned the world economy.
And that's another part of this that I think is fascinating that ties right into this prophecy is, you know, if Donald Trump proceeds with this and you do get this big inflation, this boom, and then this crash, like his fingerprints will be all over this. Now, it's not like he's the only person that has made American debt unsustainable. And it wouldn't surprise me if the majority of the debt ends up being what's there before Donald Trump comes into power. Also, America's not the only country to build up masses of debt. But if you have a crisis that comes about in that way, I mean, in the eyes of the world, Donald Trump is going to own that crisis. It will be the Trump boom, the Trump boom, and then the Trump bust, and this ties right in with that prophecy. Like if you have Donald Trump's America and the MAGA movement cause the biggest financial crisis since the 1920s, if not most likely the biggest financial crisis ever, or maybe since something like the South Sea Bubble or the Tulip Bubble in the 17th century. If he's responsible for that, you can see how that's not just going, it will do exactly as you said and provoke Europe to unite, but just really intensify their hatred for America. Like that they will blame Donald Trump and they will blame America for this, even though others are complicit, even though, there's all plenty of countries in Europe that have massive debt and it's that debt that's going to cause them this problem. They're going to say, you did this to us, and they will be out for blood. So, as Mr. Armstrong talked about, it's going to cause all these European powers to unite as a new world power, larger than either the Soviet Union or the US, but also mobilize that new power against the United States. And so this is a critical moment kind of leading into what the Bible describes as beginning with economic warfare against the United States, America being shut out from the global trading system. Again, you can see if America so directly carries the blame for this global economy destroying crisis, then they'll be shut out of the global economic system, and then ultimately that leads to hot war and the Great Tribulation, and America being conquered, taken captive, and all of this coming directly because of our financial sins and ultimately because of the sins of the nation. God is very quickly going to bring about this correction of America through this European power. But I think this story ties right in with what I wanted to talk about for Europe this week, where, I mean, Andrew, I thought you really did kind of paint the radical change that needs to happen for all of these squabbling countries. And we've seen that with the news out of Europe this week, too, just the radical kind of change that it's going to take to get Europe to unite behind a strong leader. I think it was a really interesting situation where you had at the start of this week, you know, that piece of news, that firing from Donald Trump was one of, I think, a dozen things that he got done over the weekend. And you contrast that with European politics this week, and they're just kind of stuck. And they've got all of these problems building and building towards crisis that they're not addressing. So you had the Dutch government collapse back in June and then collapse again over the weekend, which I didn't even know you could have that happen. But you had a government, you had the coalition fell apart. They've got a caretaker government that's just in charge to keep things ticking over until their election in October 29th. And the caretaker government couldn't even do that. And you had a major part of the caretaker agreement quitting. The foreign minister, Kasper Welkamp, he pulled his new social contract party out. And now you've got a government where ministers are having to wear two or three hats to cover all of the jobs. They only have 32 out of 150 parliamentary seats. So they don't even have a quarter of the seats in the Dutch parliament, let alone a majority. And there's no sign the Dutch are going to be able to form a functioning government after the election. And now you've got major disagreements between a lot of parties in the Netherlands. Now you've got disagreements over Israel forming a massive part of, forming another fault line through Dutch politics. Maybe you have two center-right parties that would otherwise perhaps get along with each other, but Geert Wilders is a very strong supporter of Israel and has been for years. And I mean, he has a very strong track record at speaking out about the dangers of Islam. And I think he probably addresses those with more courage than almost any other political leader in the world today. You have other parties, though, that are just rabidly anti-Israel, if not anti-Semitic. There's a very strong strain of that in the Netherlands. We saw what was almost a pogrom in Amsterdam several months ago. So you've got yet another thing now making it harder for parties to get along. I don't see how the Netherlands gets another government before the war in Gaza is finished. Feels like you need that to calm down before they can have a workable majority. So they're in turmoil. France, now their government seems almost certain to fall on September 8th. So we've got just over a week left of France having a government. Maybe almost certain overstates it a little, but it certainly seems on the way down and out. Here you've got François Bayrou, and he's spoken out. Here is a politician that is willing to confront the problem of runaway debt. The problem is no one else in French politics is willing to confront the problem. No, the French parliament isn't willing to confront the problem. And as a prime minister, there's only so much he can do. So he's put together a very unpopular 44 billion euro spending packet. So maybe something like 50 billion US dollars. And nobody really likes it. There are big protests that were scheduled for, I think, September 10th. And so what he's done is he set this kind of do or die vote in September 8th. Parliament either approves his cuts or they vote him out of office. And he's set up a vote of no confidence where it's basically, look, if I don't get my cuts through, you've got to get rid of me. I can't do anything. I mean, France borrows more money annually than any other Eurozone country compared to the size of its economy. Its debt is growing by nearly $6,000 every second. Again, compared to the size of its economy, it's double Germany's. And trying to fix this keeps unseating prime ministers. They've cycled through seven governments in the last decade. Bayrou only came in December. The previous prime minister only lasted about a month and a half as he grappled with this problem. So they can't get a functioning government together. They can't address their problems. Germany's economy is struggling. You had a lot of stats out this week. Bankruptcies in July were up 20% over the same month last year. It was the highest July in a decade. Industrial production fell by 1.9% in June, hitting its lowest level since COVID. Unemployment is up 170,000 in the last year. It probably crossed 3 million this month, again, making it the highest in a decade. And Friedrich Merz came into office talking a good talk about German industrial production. We're going to turn around the German economy. We're going to help German industry. And then he's not done anything on that. He's focused much more on foreign policy. And he's made some major important changes on foreign policy, certainly on Germany's military. And Rheinmetall was opening a big new factory this week. And a lot of German politicians were making big speeches there about the turnaround on their military. And yeah, they're absolutely right. It's a big deal. He has made big progress there in turning around the German military. But the German economy is kind of stuck in the too hard bin. At a party conference a week ago, Merz, he warned the welfare state that we have today can no longer be financed by what we produce in the economy. It's unsustainable. We have to make cuts. But he can't cut it with his current coalition. His coalition partners, pretty much their purpose exists for more welfare spending. That's like their number one priority. So Germany's coalition politics is stopping them from dealing with some of their biggest issues. I mean, certainly, I think on the domestic front, over the weekend, President Trump did, or at least initiated, more reforms than France and Germany have managed in the last year. So once this crisis hits that you were, this economic crisis hits that you were talking about, I mean, Europe can kind of see, well, Donald Trump may have caused this crisis, but a Trump-like leader or some energetic, decisive, vigorous, strong leader, that's what we need. We have all of these different areas where we need major changes. We need to come together and work together as one super state. We need to have our military forces work together. We need to confront our industrial decline and turnaround. We need to deal with pensions. We need to deal with welfare funding. We need to empower a strong man who can come in and address all of these things very energetically. And so that's where we are now in German politics. This is what Mr. Flory wrote shortly after Donald Trump was elected. He said, there's a big leadership vacuum. Germans know something dramatic must be done, and quickly. You see this in recent election results with the rise of fringe parties like the Alternative for Deutschland. Voters are showing themselves willing to embrace out-of-the-ordinary politics. They're clamoring for a strong leader. And then he says, this is where Bible prophecy is so invaluable. Prophecy tells us that Germany is about to shock the world with its power. I mean, really, Europe is at the crossroads. There's a lot of people saying, we're watching the death of Europe. Maybe this thing slides into a crisis and it all blows up. Maybe we're looking at the decline of Europe, where Europe becomes a museum of what it has been, while the rest of the world kind of moves on without it. But the other path is that Europeans are shocked out of their complacency. They turn things around. You have a strong leader come to power. That has happened many times throughout history. I think the French Revolution is such a powerful example, because it seems so similar. Like, you have the French debt absolutely out of control. You had people like, I think it was Jacques Necker, I can't remember his first name, but certainly Prime Minister Necker. He couldn't get it under, he wanted to get it under control. No one would support it. He didn't have the votes to do it. He ends up giving up. It explodes. It causes a crisis. And everything kind of gets worse. Everything keeps falling apart more. And it gets worse and worse and worse until finally you get a Napoleon Bonaparte step in. And people are so desperate for some stability that this country that just went crazy chopping off the heads of its king and everybody that looked too powerful, they embrace a strong leader with more power than that king had ever had. And this is what we're looking to happen for Europe. This is what I think history would tell you is a strong alternative to gradual decline or a complete fall apart. And Bible prophecy confirms, yes, this is what is happening. This is where we're going for Europe. So I thought I'd just slot in my story there because it ties in so nicely to what we were just talking about. What else, though, we had other important news from the United States. Did you want to give us the rundown of those, Andrew?
Yeah, a couple of pretty big domestic news stories just showing a lot of social problems in America and other English-speaking nations. One of the big stories that definitely made more headlines than the Federal Reserve firing this week was a shooting at a Catholic school in Minnesota, where on Wednesday, a 23-year-old man identifying as a woman entered a school with a handgun, shot 14 children, 3 adults, and then committed suicide. And so I think this is, I didn't look at the exact statistics, but this is one of the latest of the high-profile transgender mass shootings. There's been three or four over recent years. Person clearly demon-possessed, but just highlighting a problem in American culture that, like, we did an infographic a couple years ago on just mass shootings, not murders overall, but mass shootings, and just how dramatically they've been going up in the past decade or two, or really the past couple decades, highlighting the fact that the guns aren't necessarily new. There have been a lot of those in America for about 200 years. But the mental illness aspect of just the number of people who clearly have deeply disturbed mental problems just going into schools and churches and other places and conducting these mass shootings is something that is definitely increasing in the United States. Yeah, so then another related story about just social problems in Britain, Scotland in particular, about just like their ongoing struggle with immigration and gang rapes and grooming gangs over there is a viral Twitter video of a 14-year-old in Scotland with an axe and a knife standing up to two Bulgarian immigrants who had been harassing her 12-year-old sister and just pushing back against that, where I believe she was even gotten some trouble for that, for just making threats here. And I guess there may be some questions over what fully happened, since this is just a video on Twitter. But it definitely, at the very least, has highlighted the fact that there are definitely grooming gangs and a rape epidemic led by illegal immigrants in the UK that the government has been ignoring. And so this case, as to whether exactly how legit the threats against the 12-year-old sister were and how much the role the knife and the axe had in saving her, it definitely highlights the fact that children in many of these regions are kind of on their own, as the adults are not taking the broader crisis as seriously as it needs to be taken.
Well, thank you for that, Andrew. And I'll just run through some of the other stories from Europe this week. We have so many stories about the German military. I felt like we could have kind of almost put out a daily update on Germany's military rise this week. So much was happening. So we learned that the German cabinet approved more arms exports last year than in any previous year. That was according to an arms export report that Politico got the details of and published this week. The government approved 12.8 billion. So that's 15-ish US dollars, billion dollars of exports in 2024. That was up from 12.1 billion in 2023. Vast majority of these were for Ukraine. So, you know, more weapons coming out of Germany. The German cabinet also approved several bills that will help Germany boost its military power. One creates a new National Security Council that will be chaired by the Chancellor. It will include key ministers and officials from other allied countries, NATO and the EU. And the idea of this council is that it will plan for emergencies and then it will help Germany move quickly when those emergencies hit. And the other bill that they approved is a new military service bill. This is about expanding the number of personnel serving in the German military. So Germans will soon get a questionnaire after they turn 18 that will assess their willingness and ability to serve in the army. Men will have to fill it in. For women, it will be voluntary. And the purpose is to encourage more people to sign up and then to make it easier to introduce conscription if they want to do that in the future. And the government wants this as part of their efforts to increase their number of soldiers from 180,000 to 260,000 by the early 2030s. Now, these two bills still require approval from the Bundestag, German parliament, but the coalition has a massive majority, or a pretty decent majority, in that parliament. So now that the cabinet has approved these bills, yeah, they're almost certain to go through. Also, Rheinmetall opened Europe's largest artillery ammunition factory this week. It will aim to produce 350,000 rounds of 155mm ammunition by 2027. It was built in around 18 months. the CEO of Rheinmetall, he said, building this factory proves that Germany can do things quickly when it really matters. And he said how this is a German contribution to a pan-European defense ecosystem. Europe has really stepped up its production of things like artillery shells since 2023. So rapid expansion of Rheinmetall, Germany's military capacity. There's also talk recently about Lockheed Martin outsourcing production of very important US missile systems to Rheinmetall in Europe. So lots of important stories on Germany's military developing. That was the cover of our latest Trumpet print magazine. And Mr. Flurry wrote, Germany's great industrial power is being rapidly transformed for military purposes. Germany is already Europe's largest military spender, but is only at the beginning of a frightening military transformation. I mean, this will give that military edge to this power that is rising now and that is that we talked about just a few minutes ago, that God is going to use to punish the United States. And that article from Mr. Flurry is Germany is arming for World War III. We also saw Pope Leo siding against Britain and America this week. He said that he was delighted that Britain had agreed to give the Chagos Islands military base to top Chinese ally Mauritius. He called the move a significant victory that would, quote, repair an grave injustice. I can't see how giving an island to a country that has never owned it repairs any injustice. And I think it shows that the Pope is continuing one of Pope Francis's most significant legacies of rallying the world against Britain and America. And then the final story I want to talk about, and I think this introduces our next subject quite nicely, is that we've got some pretty good look at who blew up the Nord Stream pipelines this week. So you've got these Nord Stream pipelines that run between Russia and Germany. They were both blown up in 2022. And there's been a lot of speculation as to who it was. German intelligence reports kind of leaked into the German press this week. And the finger points very, very strongly at Ukraine, and that even that this was a Ukrainian government sponsored, government approved attack. So all seven suspects in this for this attack were Ukrainian citizens. They had genuine Ukrainian passports with fake names, which indicates that the Ukrainian Secret Service was involved. There are even indications that one of the attackers had previously worked for Ukraine's domestic intelligence service. And the US and Germany has issued Interpol notices, red notices for the arrest of these individuals. I mean, you look at all the evidence, it's theoretically possible that you had rogue elements within Ukraine's Secret Service doing this without government approval. I mean, that seems unlikely. We're looking at the finger pointing more and more solidly at the government signed off on this. And that raises a lot of interesting questions. What does this mean for German-Ukraine relations? You do have more and more Germans wanting their country to publicly break with the US, break with NATO, side with Russia. And now they can point to, hey, Ukraine, this theoretical ally, blew up these pipelines. I mean, we weren't using them at the time, but still, you know, we spent a lot of money into building these pipelines and Ukraine blew them up. And already without cheap raw materials from Russia, German industry is really suffering. I mean, I mentioned some of those statistics earlier. And now you've got Ukraine exposed for attacking German energy assets. I mean, some way, you know, Ukraine is correct that these are pipelines tied Germany to Russia. When the Nord Stream 2 project was finished, Mr. Flurry wrote about that in a 2008 article. He says, in fact, though Russia and Germany will not say so, this pipeline project is clearly intended to wreck NATO. So perhaps Ukraine did NATO a favor by striking these pipelines, but now that we're getting more of this exposed, I mean, this could really help shift German politics sharply against NATO. And Mr. Flurry wrote in that article, many elite Germans feel their nation has now gotten all it can from the US and they're ready to move on. Some powerful Germans today are thinking more and more about the Holy Roman Empire, and they want modern Germany to assume more power of its own in the spirit of that empire. They want to establish Europe as a mighty German-led superpower. And I think we see that desire of a Europe that's a mighty German-led superpower is clearer than ever. And this exposure, that's going to help those elites that want Germany aligned with Russia and against the United States, bring Germany around into that open alliance. And it will, again, help Germany speed up its efforts to militarize. After all, if they're vulnerable to an attack from seven guys from Ukraine, who else are they vulnerable to? Now, the German government isn't keen to address these things. But I think over the long term, this is another factor that's going to help shift Germany around and be used by those that want to break with the United States and bring Germany in a very different direction. But this talk of Ukraine does bring me around to our top story from Asia this week, where we had Russia launching the second biggest air assault of the Ukraine war. This time, instead of Ukraine attacking a German target, there was an EU building damaged in the Russian attack with at least 21 dead. And so to hear more about this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, that's right, Mr. Palmer. The war on Ukraine continues to rage on. We've just crossed the 3.5-year anniversary of this war. And of course, there are peace efforts underway right now, but Vladimir Putin just keeps on making it more and more clear that whatever he may say in meetings, he actually has zero interest in ending the war at this time. We saw this very clearly on Thursday when his forces launched, as you said, they're the second biggest air assault of the entire war. There were 598 drones and 31 missiles that Russia fired at targets in Ukraine that night. And they were fired at civilian targets, residential buildings, and civilian trains. And good news for Vladimir Putin, he succeeded in killing several civilians. So far, the death toll in Kyiv is up to 23 civilians that Putin's forces killed. Three of them were children, including a 2-year-old girl. This little girl was born during Putin's full-scale war on Ukraine. And she lived her entire life in the shadow of that war, under attack. And then she was killed this week by Putin's forces. So Putin is accomplishing his goal of terrorizing and demoralizing the population just by killing their children and others. And he also said this week that he doesn't accept Europe's plans to give Ukraine security guarantees by having European forces inside of Ukraine. That was something that's been discussed ever since President Trump met with President Putin in Alaska, and even more so since the follow-up meeting between President Trump and the Europeans. But Putin says he rejects that. And with this attack, he showed Europe and he showed President Trump and the world just how adamantly he rejects it. In this strike, as you said, Russia also hit Mission Council offices for the EU and for Britain. So that, I think, really just underscored what Putin thinks of the plan that the Europeans have come up with to try to keep Putin from taking the entirety of Ukraine. And as a result of all of this, some are now hoping that President Trump will become a little more cognizant of exactly who he's dealing with in President Putin. And some hope that President Trump might finally apply some of the sanctions that he has threatened on Russia and its partners, and that he may transfer some funds from frozen Russian assets to Ukraine. But so far, President Trump is opting to just continue with his strategy of what is essentially victim blaming and trying to flatter Putin into some sort of a peace deal. So he keeps on promising 2 more weeks. You know, he says 2 more weeks, Putin, that's all you have. And this time, if you keep bombing civilians and killing children and refusing any sort of a peace plan, this time, if you don't stop all that within 2 weeks, then America will begin to apply some pressure. But time and again, that pressure on Russia does not materialize. Instead, we just have things like President Trump saying that he plans to invite war criminal Putin to the U.S. to watch the World Cup next year. So it's an extremely naive and disturbing approach that President Trump is taking. But these developments, Russia's massive aerial barrages on Ukraine that just keep on coming, they show that Vladimir Putin's ambitions 3.5 years into this war remain undiminished. They show that he continues on just as fiercely determined as ever to control more land and more people, no matter how many billions of dollars have to be spent, no matter how many Russian lives and 2-year-old Ukrainian lives and any other lives have to be lost in the process. And however it plays out in the short term, Bible prophecy shows that Putin will come out of this still as a powerful dictator. And he'll go on to fight far more devastating wars in the future. The main prophecy that you could go to understand that is in Ezekiel chapters 38 and 39. And we have a free booklet that explains those chapters in detail, along with related passages as well. It goes into just a lot of depth about what Putin's role in the wars of the future will be. This booklet is called The Prophesied Prince of Russia, and it's one that we send out for free to anyone who would like a copy. So I hope you'll visit thetrumpet.com and order your free copy of The Prophesied Prince of Russia there.
Thank you for that, Jeremiah. You know, I got an email or two, I think, this week relating to what we talked about last week, and I think there's a point that we can make there. Basically, pointing out several immoral things, immoral leaders in Ukraine. And I think saying that Vladimir Putin is bad is not the same thing as saying Ukraine is good. And saying that saying everything that you just said is not to say Ukraine is a perfect, morally upright nation, a paragon of virtue. Like, it doesn't imply any of those things. But you look at the way that, you know, it can be any country that he's invading. You know, he invaded Georgia. He's attacked a lot of these other countries. He is a deeply evil person. And that exists independently of whatever scale on the morality of whatever country he's opposing at the moment sits. So, I thought where we're kind of revisiting some of this story, it was an opportunity to make that point. And it's a point that I think we do have a duty to make. This is an individual that is singled out in the Bible. There are not many people that are singled out in that way. And the Bible says he has a critical role to play in end time events. And that there's a warning message that has to go out about him and even to him to a certain extent. So, Mr. Flurry has an obligation, and we support him in doing that, of warning Vladimir Putin, warning about Vladimir Putin, pointing to the critical role that this individual is going to play in end time events. I mean, he is a particularly stubborn leader that is going to play a role in a war that is just incredibly punishing and that pushes mankind to the brink of extinction. And then someone ultimately who kind of continues to rebel against God and against Jesus Christ. So there's a message even in him and his behavior about the stubbornness of human nature, how much it is going to take for God to turn this world around. And we've kind of talked in the first half of this show about Europe heading for crisis, the world heading for economic crisis. It takes an even bigger crisis than that for people to finally wake up and say, we need God. We can't stop looking. We need to stop looking to ourselves for solutions, our own ways of organizing governments, our own moral systems. We don't know how to organize a world and a society and a civilization. We need to go to God, and we need to go to the Bible, and we need to let him rule us. And someone like Vladimir Putin and the level of destruction that he is willing to cause, God is allowing an individual like that there to help bring the world to that realization. So, and that's why we do have to talk about him and what he's doing.
Yes, I think that's a fair point, and I do think that we have to recognize also that when people get fixated on the shortcomings of Ukraine, when people get kind of obsessed with what may be problematic about the governance of Ukraine or Georgia or Kazakhstan or Belarus or Moldova or any of these other nations that are very much in the crosshairs of Vladimir Putin, it would be naive not to recognize that a great deal of that is because of an extremely concerted effort that Putin's regime is making to fill the bandwidth with propaganda that is anti-Ukrainian. So plenty of the criticisms are valid. What country isn't profoundly corrupt in this world? You know, there's plenty of valid criticisms, but a lot of the reason why you have especially more right-leaning people fixated on so much of this is because they are being a little bit seduced and misled by propaganda that originates from Russia. And it's easy to trace a lot of that back to Vladimir Putin. So it's, you know, so some of that, I think people need to be a little bit more judicious and a little bit more discerning with the sources that they choose to really just wholeheartedly believe in.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And I think there's also kind of a, and we tend to look at, say, the right and wrong in a war, and then there's also moral evil that kind of exists independently of that. Like, I think about this when it comes to Israel and Hamas, where very often on this show, we kind of emphasize in this war, Israel is 100% in the right, and Hamas is 100% in the right. It's black and white. There are no facets of gray. Hamas is thoroughly evil, and Israel is trying to defend itself and defend its civilians. But it is still important to note, and I think maybe we could have done a better job of this and done this more, that Israel has a lot of sins. They're not, say, a geopolitical sinner. They're not conniving to invade their neighbors. But there are some pretty incredible social sins going on in there. You know, Tel Aviv is Sodom on Sea. You had a homosexual pride parade going on, I think, in Jerusalem or planned for Jerusalem right around the 12-day war with Iran. There are a lot of things, and there are a lot of evils that are going on in Israel. Now, those same evils are going on in a lot of other countries. I mean, we're not, you know, Britain has no standing to criticize Israel on those or the United States. So there is evil there. We're not saying that the Jewish state is a perfect state and that God is confronting and correcting them for that evil. So I think, you know, there can be a lot of evil in a society, but then they can still be innocent, say, of a particular war. And I think that's the case for Ukraine. You know, I don't think they bear any responsibility for Russia invading them at all. But at the same time, is there immorality? Is that, yes, absolutely. And do they need correction? Yes. You know, all the nations of the world do. I mean, on that point on Israel and Hamas, we have an article from Trumpet executive editor Stephen Flurry in the latest Trumpet print, What is Israel's Sin? That goes into that in more detail. But I think just a digression that's maybe worth addressing, as it does come up in comments and emails a fair bit. But what else did you have from Asia this week for us, Jeremiah?
Yeah, first up, just a quick story about Vladimir Putin and North Korean Supreme Leader Kim Jong-un. They are both planning to travel to Beijing next week to join Chinese leader Xi Jinping for his big military parade. So this will be basically just a big show of defiance against the West and a big show of unity among these three revisionist powers. These three leaders, of course, they all are determined, dead set to upend the U.S.-led international order. They're all bent on doing whatever they can to destroy that global order. And now they're all getting together. Actually, for the first time, these three are getting together. And it is to oversee this military parade, showcasing the weapons of war that they expect to soon be using when their nations are fighting together as allies. So I think this is just another sobering sign of the fragility of these times and the instability of these times, and of just how determined some powerful nations are to upend the U.S.-led global order. And then one final story here about Japan. On Thursday, the Japanese announced that they have canceled a planned trip to the United States where a U.S.-Japan trade deal was supposed to be finalized. The U.S. and Japan, of course, have been close partners for decades, and it's an extremely valuable partnership for the United States. But the fact that the two sides are apparently not able to get a trade deal worked out shows that this partnership is under a great deal of strain. The tensions just keep on building, and the Trumpet expects the U.S.-Japan partnership to soon rupture. So all of this strain and these rising tensions are something that we closely watch, because it could be leading to that rupturing of the U.S.-Japan partnership.
Thank you for that, Jeremiah. Is the UN actually about to do something about Iran's nuclear program? Well, maybe. To get the latest on that, we'll go to our Middle East correspondent, Mihailo Zekic.
So yesterday, the United Kingdom, France, and Germany announced they're going to trigger snapback sanctions at the UN against Iran per the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, aka the Barack Obama nuclear deal. The nuclear deal was signed in 2015. It was to last for 10 years and was to expire this October. So if those three wanted to do anything about Iran and its nuclear program, it was basically now or never. They had a summit in Geneva a few days ago to maybe do a last-ditch attempt to get a diplomatic solution sorted out, and looks like that went nowhere. This is what the section, what the joint statement read, quote, "Today, Iran's non-compliance with the JCPOA is clear and deliberate, and sites of major proliferation concern in Iran are outside of IAEA or the UN's Atomic Energy Agency monitoring. Iran has no civilian justification for its highly enriched uranium stockpile. Its nuclear program, therefore, remains a clear threat to international peace and security," end quote. Now, what does all this mean? Well, the sanctions don't get implemented until about a month from now, but they're non-vetoable in the Security Council, meaning Iran's friends Russia and China can't really get in the way. What exactly are these sanctions? Well, they mean a conventional arms embargo enforceable throughout the mechanisms of the UN rather than just through the United States. How that would even not exist at this point, considering everything else Iran has done, is beyond me. But it also includes an international ban on Iran's enrichment and missile development programs, and allows other countries to enact their own mechanisms against Iran individually. What's Iran's response to this? Well, Iran's parliament is already drafting legislation to remove Iran from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. They've already been against that for years now, but now that they're officially leaving it, which, if memory serves me right, is either the only country to ever leave it or second after North Korea, that basically means they're declaring we are going to go ahead with a nuclear weapons program. Europe is still, all three countries are still saying that a diplomatic solution is possible if Iran will come to the negotiating table, but Iran's been coming to the negotiating table and offering nothing in exchange for asking for everything and expecting its bullying to get its way. And if it hasn't gone to the negotiating table after the U.S. and Israel bombed its facilities, if it hasn't gone to the negotiating table after all these years, it's probably not going to go to now.
So it seems very likely these sanctions are going to go ahead. There's nothing that Russia or China alone can do to stop them. It would require the entire permanent members of the Security Council, I guess, all to prevent these sanctions going ahead, which would mean European countries having to change their minds, or all of the E3 to change their minds. That snapback will require the UN to put sanctions on Iran. Russia and China, because they're permanent members of the UN Security Council, can completely ignore that and then block any punishment that they would receive for violating those sanctions. Presumably they could shield other countries from any punishment for violating those sanctions. So, I mean, is this an important symbolic step of Europe combating Iran, but only a symbolic step? Or is this going to have a practical effect on Iran?
Well, a lot depends on what Russia and China do. There could very well be some wrangling, like some concessions in Ukraine, for example, in exchange for Russia's participation.
Right. I think we could probably take it for granted that Russia and China will completely ignore the sanctions and side with Iran. So if they do that, then does it have any meaningful impact?
Well, now third-party countries have UN authorization, if you could say, to enact their own sanctions. A lot of them have been a bit afraid to hurt Iran in this way. If they were just siding, say, only with the United States, if they were only siding with Donald Trump, now they have a bit more of an umbrella to do so. And Iran's currency has already had like a plummet within the past 24 hours with the news breaking out. And also, this isn't necessarily something that's spelt out in official policy, but this does put these European countries in a new light with Iran. To this point, Europe has been seen as like the middleman that can speak between Iran and America, the party that's trusted by both sides to channel information and to soften the other's position. At this point, Europe is basically throwing its lot in, no, we see what you're up to. We're not going to look the other way anymore. We are against you. And the fact that Iran's pulling out of the treaty now, as opposed to with everything else the United States has done under Donald Trump against Iran, I think this shows how much this is hurting, Iran is taking this personally. Before, Europe was not really seen as a main player, and now Iran's saying, okay, you are as much of somebody that we are going to be against as much as the United States now.
So there are some practical consequences of this, and even that symbolic gesture of Europe nailing its colors to the mast and saying we're on the anti-Iran side, that alone has practical impacts. So this is something, this shift in Europe and in Germany's position, this hardening against Iran, this is something we've been watching over several years because of some very specific Bible prophecies.
Yes, one in particular, that's Daniel 11, verse 40. I'll read it out. At the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships, and he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. Lot to unpack there. What does that mean? Well, this is what Trump Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury said in a 2016 Key of David about this verse. This is clip one.
Notice Daniel 11 and verse 40. Here is that Holy Roman Empire, and notice what it does. And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north, that's the Holy Roman Empire, led by Germany, shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships, and he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. The king of the north is going to destroy, this man is going to destroy another king of radical Islam, which is Iran, by far the most, the biggest terrorist sponsoring nation in the world. And the Holy Roman Empire is going to destroy them. Now you just watch this and you can see it happen. We won't have to wait that long.
Now, he said that in 2016, but that's basically a summary of what Mr. Fleury has been saying about Daniel 11, about Iran, about Germany since the early 1990s. You go back then, Germany was not the power player it is today, and Iran was an isolated pariah state that wasn't even the main sponsor of terror in the Middle East. Since then, we're seeing Iran and Germany get more and more into loggerheads. And this deal that was made by Barack Obama, and Mr. Fleury's had a lot to say about his involvement in this nuclear deal and Iran's nuclear program as well, it brings in Germany into the picture. Germany's not a member of the Security Council. Germany would not even necessarily need a seat at the table of this, except for the fact that Obama included Germany in this deal. And now this deal is being used as an avenue, I guess you could say, for Iran and Germany to become more hostile to each other. And nuclear weapons will play a role in Germany's reactions against Iran. This is what Mr. Fleury had to say in 2024.
They want to get the nuclear bombs. And what are they going to be like after they get those nuclear bombs, when you consider what they're doing right now without them? Well, Germany is aware of that too, and probably want to strike before they get those nuclear bombs, which many, many authorities say is probably going to happen this very year. So the danger is intensifying. Time is running out, and Germany knows that. And there's going to be a clash, and they're going to have a whirlwind around Iran, and they're going to destroy that nation in a short amount of time. And yet, see, Iran doesn't realize just how dangerous this is, what they're involved in.
Mr. Fleury has written in his book, The King of the South, which is all about Iran and what's happening there right now, that Germany sees what Iran is up to, and Germany is planning for a clash. This includes different involvements in Middle Eastern proxy wars and establishing overseas bases, but nuclear weapons, as I said, also plays a big part in it. And you see Germany taking an active role in countering Iran's nuclear weapons. When you see Iran getting as angry as they are about all of this, you can expect this trend to just keep progressing more and more. So keep your eyes what happens, not just between Iran and Germany in general, but even just within the next few weeks, how Iran responds to this activation, how Germany and the other countries that activated respond, and how the global community responds. If you'd like to learn more, the King of the South is a good one-stop shop to explain Daniel 11, verse 40, and many other prophecies that relate to Iran, that relate to the Middle East, and how they affect Europe.
Great, thank you for that. Now, this has been a major prophesied shift. I mean, this is in many ways a great example of fulfilled prophecy, where the first JCPOA, Europe, Germany, they were right out the door with a whole bunch of business deals that they wanted to do with Iran. And now they're kind of almost taking the lead in trying to put sanctions back on Iran. Exactly as Daniel 11 forecasts, Europe is stepping up. Their position on Iran has shifted. They're even starting to take the lead in fighting Iran or dealing with Iran. So a very important major shift there, and one where you can see Bible prophecy having been proven right, where Europe is shifting from a supporter to Iran to its leading antagonist. Now, what other important stories do you have from the Middle East for us this week?
One, I'd like to focus on the UN has declared officially there is a famine in Gaza. It shouldn't surprise that there's big things happening there. It is a war zone. It is one of the most densely populated places on Earth. But you combine that with everything else that the UN has said about Gaza and Israel, how you have officials like Francesca Albanese openly declaring that Israel is committing genocide, and you can see this is just another attempt to delegitimize everything Israel is doing there and make Israel look out to be the aggressor, the bad guy that needs to be stopped. We went into this in more detail, or you did rather, in this Wednesday's Trumpet World, which if people would like to learn more about that, they could go and watch that.
Yeah, that's where we got a representative from the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation on the show. Great to talk to someone who's just very plugged into what events are like on the ground and it gives a unique view of what has been going on in Gaza. So you can get that on Wednesday's show. Thank you so much for that, Mihailo. Thank you to all of our panelists. Thank you to you, the viewer, to George Haddad and Victor Granados for engineering and production. If you have any questions, comments on the show, you can get in touch with us, trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll be back with our regular show on Wednesday. Until then, keep watching your world.